Bonsoir. Good evening, everybody. If I could ask you all to take your seats, we're just about ready to begin. So good evening. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Rosalie Jukier, and I'm delighted to be the co-chair and co-organizer of our Formation Continue series for this evening. Thank you for being here despite this weather. I hope you agree that we've had a wonderful year filled with topics that have been based on recent major Canadian court decisions, mostly coming out of the Supreme Court of Canada or on their way there. This is the last of our Formation Continue evenings for this year. Tonight will be no exception. We will continue on the theme of major and controversial, somewhat controversial, Supreme Court of Canada decisions. So this year, this series has taken us into areas of law as diverse as private international law and copyright law, as well as into topics such as the right to die and safe injection sites. Et pour terminer notre année, nous allons visiter un sujet pas mal controversé, l'UNICAB devant les tribunaux, inspiré par la décision toute récente de la Cour suprême dans MS contre la Reine. I know that many of you are not here just tonight, but are regulars. For those of you who have been here for most of the lectures this year, I hope you've enjoyed the 15 hours of continuing legal education that we've offered this year, and the now 60 hours we have offered over the past 4 years. We have certainly tried to pull out all the stops for you to offer the best we can, top-notch professors and speakers, interesting topics, and a well-organized lecture series. Now, as you know, we offer this series, this formation series, literally free of charge. The $20 you pay per lecture, as you can well imagine, does not cover our costs, however minimal they are. We don't have administrative or secretarial help, but we do provide live feeding into the rooms across the hall so that more lawyers and notaries can benefit from our educational outreach program. And we do hire a student to help with the organization and students to work manning the tables in the atrium. Perhaps this is an opportune moment to recognize the hard work and wonderful results of Benjamin Flight, who was our student coordinator until this past December, and Graham McVannell, who is sitting up there and who has taken over in January and who has done an absolutely terrific job, made it seem all seamless for you and, frankly, for me and my co-chair, Véronique Bélanger. So thank you very much, Graham. But my colleague Véronique Bélanger and myself, we co-organize these series and we work on a pro bono basis, as do all the lecturers and volunteers that have serviced these series over the years. As such, I would like to ask you all to consider giving something back to the faculty as recognition for what we have done by way of this educational outreach in order to help us maintain our excellence in this program and in all our other endeavors. So no amount is too little, or of course too much. So please, if you would, take the time to fill out the pledge card that you were handed upon registration this evening. And on behalf of the faculty and in advance, I thank you for your help and your generosity. So before we begin with the formal part of the program, let me, as usual, make some housekeeping announcements. If you haven't done so already, turn off anything that buzzes, rings, or makes noise of any kind. Just to let you know, the plan of this evening is that we will have a break this evening, and it will be after the first two speakers, so it will be closer to about 7:30. There will be, as you can see from the table, a joint question and answer period at the end after the three speakers have spoken. I know that this is a subject and a case and presentations that will yield many interesting questions, so think of them as the lecturers are presenting. You can write them down on a piece of paper and hand them to us or one of the volunteers, or we will, if you are in this particular room, you'll be able to raise your hand and ask the questions. During the break, as usual, you will find snacks at the table in the atrium manned by our students. Again, as always, the food is not for sale. Rather, the students would simply appreciate donations for what you take. And note that tonight, all the proceeds will go to support the Graduate Law Students Association. They represent the graduate students in our faculty. This year, if you've been here for our past lectures, you will have had the good fortune of meeting two of our graduate students who presented in prior lectures. The students need this money in particular because they will be putting on a wonderful graduate student conference this coming May, so please give generously for the food and drink that they have graciously provided for you. And, of course, you will receive an email shortly after this evening's program with your attestation certificates. We do realize that the period is over for the 60 hours of CLE. The two-year period is over March 31st. We are aware of that. You'll receive your attestation for this evening's program very shortly. Of course, in order for you to receive that, you will have had to register with one of the students at the tables in the atrium. If you haven't done so already, please do so during the break. Okay, that's it for housekeeping announcements. And now I'm going to turn to one of my favorite parts of the program, which is where I get to present the président d'honneur that we have chosen for this evening. And tonight I'm particularly delighted to introduce our président d'honneur, Bernard Grenier. Although there is a lot to say about our président d'honneur, first and foremost is that he served as a judge in the Criminal and Penal Division of the Cour de Québec from 1980 until 2002. We are really delighted to have such a distinguished judge, juge à la retraite, with us tonight. Criminal law has really been Maître Grenier's passion from the outset. Après avoir été admis au barreau du Québec en 1967, il a œuvré en droit pénal au bureau d'assistance judiciaire du barreau de Montréal, a travaillé au ministère du solliciteur général à Ottawa, a pratiqué le droit pénal au Centre communautaire juridique de Montréal, a été président de la Société de criminologie du Québec et dirige des travaux de recherche en droit pénal à la Faculté de droit de l'Université de Montréal depuis 15 ans. His abilities and good judgment have not gone unnoticed. In August 2003, Maître Grenier was appointed by the Quebec Bar as an observer at a mega trial taking place at the Gouin Judicial Services Centre. In November 2003, he became special advisor to the Minister of Justice of Canada in matters of judicial errors. And in January 2006, he was appointed investigation commissioner by the Director General of Elections in Quebec for the Option Canada case. He is currently counsel at the firm Sherman Longo Grenier, and given his illustrious career and the fact that tonight's decision in S versus R is a criminal law decision in which the accused wished to wear a niqab while testifying, we could think of no more appropriate a président d'honneur than Bernard Grenier. Maître Grenier, je vous passe la parole.
Merci beaucoup. Avant de commencer, permettez-moi de vous faire, part d'une réflexion qu'avait eue un de mes collègues, juge à la Cour, lorsqu'il avait su que j'avais été nommé conseiller spécial du ministre de la Justice en matière d'erreurs judiciaires. Et il m'a dit la chose suivante. Tu sais ce dont tu parles quand tu parles d'erreurs judiciaires, tu en as tellement commis que tu es un candidat idéal. Je vais partager avec vous quelques incidents, quelques anecdotes qui restent entre vous et moi. Ça ne sort pas d'ici. Comme vous le savez, la charte a été adoptée en avril 82. À ce moment-là, j'étais à la Cour depuis 2 ans et j'avais vécu mes 2 premières années sans charte. Et là, la charte a été adoptée. Alors, mon juge en chef m'a demandé de vérifier si ça allait changer quelque chose, au fond. Parce que nous, on était des criminalistes, alors c'était surtout les articles 7 et 14 qui étaient notre pain quotidien. Alors il me dit, vérifie donc ça, puis tu nous feras part de tes commentaires. Alors j'ai fait des petites vérifications rapides, j'ai lu certaines choses, et on s'est réunis ensemble, les juges et moi, et je leur ai dit, au fond, là, avec l'article 24, 1 et 2, avec l'article 1, au fond, là, ça ne change pas grand-chose. Ceci reste entre vous et moi. Comme vous le savez, auparavant, avant avril 82, une toute preuve pertinente était admise, quelle que soit la méthode dont la preuve avait été obtenue. Et inutile de vous dire que ce n'est plus le cas maintenant et que les articles, surtout 7 à 14, imposent des obligations à la poursuite de prouver que la preuve a été obtenue dans le respect des droits constitutionnels de l'accusé. La décision dont on va traiter aujourd'hui est intéressante parce qu'elle montre que cette charte, prévoyant différentes garanties, faisait en sorte que parfois, inévitablement, il allait y avoir un choc, que certains droits allaient s'entrechoquer parce qu'ils visent à assurer le respect des droits de l'accusé, mais chacun dans son domaine. Alors ici, le droit, la liberté religieuse versus le droit de défense pleine et entière, cet entrechoc entre ces deux valeurs-là, ces deux droits-là, ces deux garanties, se manifeste de façon évidente dans ce jugement. Il y a des pays, dont la France, si je me souviens bien, qui ont choisi d'interdire le port du niqab, etc., de façon à peu près totale. Ici, au Canada, on a adopté une attitude plus modérée, de façon à ce qu'il n'y a pas de réponse toute faite à toute situation. Et il faut donc s'assurer que lorsqu'il y a les deux droits s'entrechoquent, à un moment donné, il va peut-être falloir faire ce qu'on a la Cour suprême essayé de faire, des accommodements raisonnables, si on peut s'exprimer ainsi. La charte fait en sorte qu'on tente, dans des situations en particulier comme celle-ci et d'autres, de créer une espèce d'équilibre entre les droits de l'un et les droits de l'autre, et c'est ce qu'on a fait dans cette décision-là. Une charte des droits et libertés n'est pas nécessairement populaire dans tous les pays, dans tous les systèmes. Et si on a le temps ce soir, je vais peut-être demander à Matt Sherman, qui est allé rencontrer il y a plusieurs années les barristers anglais à Euro Disney. Le congrès a eu lieu à Euro Disney parce qu'il n'y avait pas d'hôtel assez gros à Londres. Et l'idée, le but de l'exercice, c'était de discuter des avantages et des inconvénients d'une charte des droits et libertés. Et ce qui est intéressant, c'est que eux, ce qu'ils craignaient avec un document comme la charte, c'était que le droit ne sera pas aussi clair, aussi prévisible, aussi certain qu'il l'est aujourd'hui. Alors, je pense que l'expérience de Matt Sherman en vaut la peine et peut-être qu'elle pourra en dire quelques mots. Alors, écoutez, vous n'êtes pas venu ici pour m'entendre et je vous comprends. Je peux vous assurer que, avec la qualité des trois présentatrices que nous avons aujourd'hui, vous allez sortir d'ici enrichi. Merci.
Bonsoir. It's a great pleasure to introduce to you our first speaker, Ms. Eva Krajewska, a graduate of the faculty, who is joining us tonight having traveled from Toronto to be with us. Given the weather we enjoyed earlier today, we were not sure we would have a first speaker to introduce to you at all. But here she is, thanks to her willingness to brave the elements, and we are thrilled and grateful to have her with us. Eva Krajewska is an associate at Borden Ladner Gervais in Toronto, and she maintains a broad and diverse practice, including public and administrative law, estates law, mental health law, and commercial litigation. Her clients have included individuals and trust companies in estate matters, administrative tribunals, public officials, and hospitals. Eva is an experienced advocate before the Ontario Review Board. She has also argued appeals at the Ontario Court of Appeal and appeared for an intervener before the Supreme Court of Canada. She is a frequent writer and speaker on the issue of administrative tribunals' jurisdiction to grant charter remedies. Eva has been an active executive member of the Ontario Bar Association's Constitutional, Civil Liberties, and Human Rights section. In 2011, she appeared in front of the Supreme Court on behalf of the Muslim Canadian Congress, intervener in the RVNS case, of which she will speak to us tonight. Please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Ms. Eva Krzyzewska. Do you want to do that?
Merci Véronique et merci Rosalie. Je suis ravie d'être de retour à Montréal, même si c'est pour seulement une soirée. So I'm here to introduce the case to you and speak about the judicial process that led to the Supreme Court decision. In my view, I think it's important to kind of go back and see what actually happened at the beginning. Often Supreme Court decisions, I find, are very sanitized. Everything has gotten to them, it's packaged in a certain way, and the judges get to write the legal reasoning. But I think the facts and the way this case came forward is quite interesting. And so, as a lot of trial lawyers like to say, I'd like to start off by bringing you back to the trenches and then coming back up to the Supreme Court decision. So what were the underlying allegations in this case? NS had alleged that she was sexually assaulted repeatedly as a child by her uncle and by her cousin. This occurred in the 1980s, but the accused were finally charged only in 2007. At the outset of the preliminary inquiry, the accused sought an order requiring NS to remove the niqab. There was no evidence filed on this motion. The judge asked, well, I'd like to know her position. Why does she wear the niqab? And she wasn't in court that day. And the Crown asked, well, could we perhaps adjourn? Maybe she needs counsel before we proceed into this inquiry. And the judge is like, no, why don't we just have her come over here? I'll just ask her a few questions, and we'll see where she stands on this. And so the police officer went out, gave her a call. She came in, and the judge was and the accused lawyers were like, well, we'd like to cross-examine her on this belief that she has, that she has to wear the niqab. And they're just like, no one's going to ask her questions. I'm just going to ask her a few questions. She didn't take the oath. She just sat down in the box, and he asked her a few questions. So he said he was just going to examine her informally. And so this is, from the transcript, a bit of the exchange between Justice Wiseman at the preliminary inquiry with NS. And she says her objection to taking off the veil is very strong. It's a respect issue, one of modesty, and one of Islam we call honor. She goes on to talk about to whom she's allowed to show her face and to whom she's not, and she talks about how she would feel more comfortable if she didn't have to show her face. And after the judge hears this, he's like, okay, well, looks like she probably should get counsel, and why don't we adjourn this why don't we adjourn this until she gets counsel? And then afterwards, everything proceeded on this assumption that she never got cross-examined. All the way to the Court of Appeal, up until the Supreme Court, everybody had just assumed that this was the extent of the examination, and then there was some information given to the judge that she had actually taken off the veil to have her driver's license taken, photograph taken. And it's only like a few weeks before the Supreme Court hearing that one of the respondents files this cross-examination transcript. I don't know how it was that everybody had forgotten that this had happened, but nobody ever refers to this transcript until we get to the Supreme Court. So Justice Wiseman had adjourned matters. They came back on for hearing, and as had counsel there, she was cross-examined by counsel for one of the accused. And the line of questioning really was, are there any exceptions to when you take off the veil? Like, what about for medical examinations? Have you taken your veil off for medical examinations? And she says, well, no, I have a woman who's my physician. And I'm like, well, what about your passport photo? Well, no, I had my passport photo taken in 2001, and I only started wearing the niqab in 2002, and I've only been wearing it for the last 5 years. Okay, well, what about your driver's license? Oh, yes, I did take off my veil for my driver's license photograph. There was a female photographer who took the photo. I was shielded away from the other people in the office, so I felt comfortable. And then there is a following line of questions about, well, would there be other circumstances where you would take off the veil? And so here's a portion of that transcript where she talks about, well, you know, if I was crossing the border, I would take off the veil maybe. So there's this whole line of questioning that happens. And the Justice Wiseman, at the end of the day, makes a decision on this. And it's a controversial decision for a number of reasons. First of all, this is all happening in the context of a preliminary inquiry. And I know Isabel Sherman's going to talk more about this point, but this is very important because a judge at a preliminary inquiry does not have the jurisdiction to grant a charter remedy. So the Crown is making submissions about how Justice Wiseman does not actually have the jurisdiction to deal with this issue. Justice Wiseman says, no, I'm not granting a charter remedy. What I'm doing is determining an evidentiary issue. And as I do that, I have the jurisdiction to balance charter values. I have the jurisdiction to interpret the criminal code in accordance with charter values, and I'm balancing the accused right to make full answer in defense and NS's freedom of religion. And then he goes on to say, you know, I don't think that her belief in wearing the veil is very strong. And he uses this term strong because she has taken off her veil when she had her driver's license taken. And she also said that it would just make her more comfortable not to take off her veil while testifying. So this is the order that he makes. And so now NS, she is represented by counsel, David Butt, who stays with her all the way up to the Supreme Court. She brings an application in the nature of certiorari to quash the order and an application under Section 24.1 of the Charter. And she first talks about the fact that this is the preliminary inquiry. The judge did not have the jurisdiction to grant this remedy, that it was a violation of her right to freedom of religion, and that the whole process that the preliminary inquiry judge followed, this whole I'm going to question you on an informal basis, was in breach of her procedural fairness rights and therefore resulted in jurisdictional error. So this comes on before Justice Morocco at the Superior Court in Ontario. And Justice Morocco, he agrees that what Justice Wiseman has done doesn't look right. He thinks that this whole element of analyzing how strong her belief was not in accordance with the Supreme Court's decision in Amsalem. What you're supposed to decide is whether the belief is sincere, not how strong it is. And so he sends it back to the preliminary inquiry judge with a direction. And the direction he determines is, first, NS should be allowed to testify wearing the niqab and assert her sincere religious reason for doing so. And she can be cross-examined on this. And then after that, if it's determined that she has a sincere religious belief for wearing the niqab, she should be allowed to wear it. And then she can be cross-examined on her evidence. And if the preliminary inquiry judge that finds that during this examination, somehow it's not a good cross-examination because she's wearing the niqab, well, then he can exclude this evidence. So that's what Justice Morocco decides. This then goes to the Ontario Court of Appeal. And the judges sitting at the Ontario Court of Appeal who hear this case are Justice Doherty, Moldaver, and Sharp. And I mention their names only because a lot of people would think Justice Doherty and Moldaver are regarded as maybe the preeminent criminal minds in Ontario. This is about the time when people were considering who's going to replace judges at the Supreme Court, and everybody would always say Justice Doherty and Justice Sharp deserve to be on the Supreme Court. And who is it who ends up on the Supreme Court? Justice Moldaver. But anyways, Justice Moldaver is very well regarded. I'm not saying anything bad about him. I just think it's interesting that the three of them are the ones who are sitting as the panel for this case. And Justice Doherty is the one who writes the reasons for the court. And so he goes through all of the issues. And on the first point, he talks about jurisdiction. So yes, there is no remedial jurisdiction under the charter for a judge in a preliminary inquiry, but they do have the jurisdiction to balance charter values. And this is exactly what the judge did, so Justice Doherty accepts this analysis. And then he goes into the fair trial rights of the accused. So, yes, the accused have a statutory right to cross-examine a witness called by the Crown, but not every limit on the right to cross-examine compromises trial fairness. There is no constitutional right to confront a complainant in Canada. And so we have to really look a little bit more specifically about what is the right here and what's being infringed. And he also talks about what's the context of this case that's very important. And he talks about, first of all, how is it that wearing the niqab interferes with the trier of fact assessment based on demeanor? What is it exactly that's missing? Then he talks about how would this be different if this were a jury trial versus a judge alone trial? He says maybe a judge alone, this wouldn't pose as much difficulty. Maybe it would pose more difficulties for a jury. He also says there may be a difference between a preliminary inquiry where the nature of the evidence, or like the conclusions that are coming from the evidence, are not the same ones that are going to flow at trial. He also talks about what's the nature of the evidence to be given by the witness. Is this evidence that's essential to the trial, or is it not essential to the trial and to the findings of fact? Is it peripheral? I mean, in this case, it's, you know, she is the complainant in a sexual assault case, so it's going to be very significant evidence. The nature of the defense to be advanced, and any specific grounds linking the ability to see the witness's face. So is there going to be a defense that is going to be linked specifically to seeing her face? And later on, Justice Abella kind of picks up on this issue where, you know, if the allegation is aggravated assault and something happened to the victim's face, well, then maybe part of her face is actually the evidence, more than just her demeanor and determinations about credibility. And then he talks about the broader constitutional values that are engaged in this case. He talks about how NS is a Muslim, a minority that many believe is unfairly maligned and stereotyped in contemporary Canada, and how that should go in favor of allowing her to wear the niqab while testifying. Also that she is an alleged victim in a sexual assault case, and there is a problem of victims coming forward at all and prosecuting these charges. But then on the other side of the scale is the visible administration of criminal justice in open courts, where everyone is identified and known to the public. And in the end, I should go previous here. In the end, Justice Doherty lays out this framework. So he's not delimiting a strict test. He's really saying the trial judge should take into account all of these issues in determining whether she should be allowed to wear her niqab or whether it is an infringement of the accused's rights. So NS seeks leave to the Supreme Court. And at the Supreme Court, there are a number of interveners who come forward to make submissions on the case. I wrote interveners for the niqab, but what I really should have said is interveners for the complainant. So you had the South Asian Legal Clinic, who stressed the importance of access to justice, especially for complainants who are minorities and complainants who are victims of sexual assault. But the Barbara Schleifer Commemorative Clinic made submissions to the court about how the initial onus should be on the accused to demonstrate that his right to a fair trial is compromised, that the accused should carry the onus, and that the presumption should be that NS should be allowed to wear the niqab. Leaf also filed a motion to leave to intervene and talked about the history of discriminatory demands made of women in sexual assault cases, and that this should inform the court's reasoning and lead to the conclusion that she should be allowed to wear her niqab. The CCLA also made similar submissions, and so did the Canadian Council on American-Islamic Relations. They talked about a presumption of admissibility with respect to the testimony of women in niqab, so it's kind of similar to what the Barbara Schleifer Commemorative Clinic stated. The Canadian Criminal Lawyers Association intervened on behalf of the accused and made submissions about the right of the accused to make full answer and defense, and the importance of demeanor to the trier of fact, and the advocate's ability to effectively cross-examine. So this whole time, there were always two arguments for NS to remove her niqab. One was the trier of fact, the trial judge, the preliminary inquiry judge, the decision maker, how he or she is going to be able to make determinations about the evidence if they can't see a person's face. And then the other argument was the advocate, counsel for the accused. Are they able to cross-examine effectively without seeing the accused's face? And the Criminal Lawyers Association argued that for a lawyer, when you're cross-examining somebody, all these little cues, this little twitch, you know, the blush, the little movements, skilled lawyers, skilled cross-examiners pick up on these tiny indicia in their cross-examination. And if they don't have this, it impedes their ability to effectively cross-examine. And that impedes the accused's right to a fair trial. The Ontario Human Rights Commission, who had actually been an intervener at the case since the Superior Court, they had really just been presenting an argument about how do we reconcile rights. We have two rights, freedom of religion, accused right to a fair trial. There, it's a shock, as Bernard said. And how are we going to reconcile them? The Barreau du Québec also intervened. They had a more general submission about there's no hierarchy of rights, and we have to try to find an equilibrium. But if not, then she should have to remove her niqab. And we intervened on behalf of the Muslim Canadian Congress. And the Muslim Canadian Congress, I know a lot of it's... Muslim Canadian Congress is a secular Muslim organization, and so the Muslim Canadian Congress actually intervened on the issue of there should be a meaningful and particularized inquiry into her sincere religious belief and why she believes that she has to wear the niqab, and whether this is linked to her religion or whether it's motivated on other grounds. The Muslim Canadian Congress has taken the position in books and literature and in the media previously that the niqab is not an element actually of Islam, but is an oppressive tool used against women. And the Muslim Canadian Congress had also been an intervener at the Ontario Court of Appeal and ran a whole argument under Section 15 of the Charter. That issue was not brought forward at the Supreme Court. And the NS, in her factum, There are a few things that were interesting about her, their fact. And first of all, David Butt used these, put little elephants in his factum, which you don't usually see lawyers doing that, but he put little elephants in his factum, and he talked about how there's three elephants in the room. And a lot of his argument focused on this court should not focus on these three elephants. And the three elephants were about what is the niqab, is it oppressive to women, what is its significance. He was like, that's not what the court should focus on. The court should not start to worry about the underlying issues about the niqab, but should really focus on demeanor evidence. And he really focused his submissions on how demeanor evidence is not actually everything that everybody makes it out to be. There's all these studies that say that actually, judges are not very good at making findings of credibility. They're not really good at finding liars based on just the way people are answering questions. The problem was, though, that as we saw at the beginning, there was very little evidence going forward to the Supreme Court, right? This was not a case unlike the prostitution case in Ontario, where you had experts talking about, you know, the harms of prostitution versus the harms of the law prohibiting prostitution. There wasn't all this evidence. And so that was pretty hard for him to overcome at the court. Now, an interesting point on the interveners in this case, this is the first time I've seen this in a while, but usually when you bring a motion to intervene at the Supreme Court, everyone who writes a factum, everyone's gotten used to the idea that everyone who writes a factum and is allowed to intervene will get a chance to make 10 minutes of oral submissions. And in this case, only three did. And the Supreme Court doesn't give reasons for why that was, but now that's become a little bit of a pattern. Now, even though interveners draft factums and submit factums, it doesn't mean you're going to have a chance to make oral submissions. And the Supreme Court only wanted to hear from the Barbara Schleifer Clinic, who advanced the argument about that the onus should be on the accused, the Muslim Canadian Congress, and the Criminal Lawyers Association. And my impression from the hearing was two things. Both Justice LaBelle and Justice Fish were very tough and posed very hard questions to David Butt, counsel for NS, about the right to cross-examine and the right to a fair trial. And Justice Fish was like, well, you know, like as a lawyer, as a counsel, how can you ask questions and do a good cross-examination if you can't see the witness? And David Butt was like, well, what about blind lawyers? They're still good lawyers. And that stuff didn't appear in the judgment anywhere. Nobody struggled with that issue. But it was a good exchange. And the Chief Justice was very concerned about, you know, everybody talks about this language of, oh, you know, when the two rights collide, we should reconcile rights. We're in the business of reconciling rights. And the Chief Justice was very concerned about, like, what does this mean, this reconciliation? Like, how can you reconcile rights? And she had a lot of questions for counsel about how do you really do that? And nobody was really able to, you know, find a satisfying answer. I think most people had to concede at some point that on some level you determine that one right trumps another. Again, we don't necessarily see that conclusion in the judgment, but or expressly laid out in the judgment, but it is, this case, you know, really does ask the question, can you reconcile rights, or do you just have to admit that on some level we are going to allow one right to trump another? So one of the issues on this case is this all started at the preliminary inquiry stage. This is already a sexual assault that happened 20, 25 years ago. This started at the preliminary inquiry stage. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and everything has stayed up until that point. These accused are not, this is not going to trial until this gets resolved. And this was heard in November of 2011, and the reasons, December of 2011, and the reasons were released in December of 2012. So the court took a year still to make a decision on this, because I think they really were struggling with it, and the court split three ways. So you had the Chief Justice writing the majority's reasons, Justice LaBelle and Justice Rothstein next, and Justice Abella was dissenting. And the first set of reasons really tries to form this balancing and lays out a test where, okay, how are we going to do this balancing? We're not going to do a strict line. We're going to do a balancing. Justice LaBelle and Justice Rothstein say, no, bright line, no niqabs, we're not going there. Justice Abella goes the other way, and she says, no, you can always wear a niqab unless in a very specific circumstance where the identity of the complainant is at issue. And in my view, although the first set of reasons the Chief Justice writes as if we are going to do a balancing, in my view, when I think about this case and I read the reasons, I see it more as most of the time the niqab is going to have to come off. That's the way I read the reasons, but I'm happy to hear contrary opinions. So this is the framework that the Chief Justice works out. Would requiring the witness to remove the niqab while testifying interfere with her freedom of religion? So first stage is section 2B analysis, freedom of religion. Would permitting the witness to wear the niqab while testifying create a serious risk to trial fairness? So then we're going to the accused's right to trial fairness. Step three is there any way to accommodate both rights? And then step four is, if we can't accommodate them, how do we weigh the salutary effects versus the deleterious effects of removing the niqab? So it's interesting that the whole framework is about the niqab first. That's the onus. That's the starting point. The framework does not start off with, is there an infringement of the accused's right to a fair trial? You could see how it could have been the other way around. This could have been all flipped the other way, like a lot of the interveners had proposed. So, freedom of religion. We're back to the Amsalem case. The Amsalem case is the case of the Orthodox Jews in Montreal who had wanted to have a sukkah on their balconies, and that's where the Supreme Court developed the idea that when somebody asserts a practice, they just have to demonstrate that they sincerely believe that their religion requires them to do this. So she would have to demonstrate sincerity of belief. And sincerity of belief everyone has always said it's not a very high threshold. You don't have to show that you've been a consistent and amazing practitioner and believer. You can have lapses. The court is not supposed to also inquire into the dogma. So the court isn't supposed to say, well, I'm sorry, where in the Quran does it say you have to wear a niqab? The court is not allowed to go into the religious doctrine. It's supposed to assess whether this person sincerely believes that their religion requires them to do this. The chief is also critical of the inquiry judge. Again, everybody comes back to, oh, I don't think you should have talked about the strength of her belief. That was not the right way to go about this. And so she says the matter should be returned to the preliminary inquiry judge. So that's really where, if you were going to just decide the case right there, you might have just ended right there. But the Supreme Court hears these cases in order to give guidance to lower courts on how to do this next time. So the second stage is serious risk to trial fairness. So the chief mentions, there was no expert evidence in this case on the importance of seeing a witness's face to effectively cross-examine. There was nothing. There was one article filed in the briefs that was an unpublished article, and so everybody was like, well, we can't rely on this. But the Chief Justice says there is a very strong common law history and pronouncements by the courts that you should be able to see a witness's face. So even though it's not a constitutional right, face-to-face confrontation is the norm. She talks about how the whole idea of why we give deference, why appellate courts give deference to trial judges, is because they have the ability to see the witnesses' faces and make assessments of credibility on that basis. So she finds that there would be, based on this common law tradition, and basically I think she leaves it open, you know, maybe in the future somebody will present evidence and we can find differently if this is fully discussed. But right now, based on our traditions and our experiences, you do have to see a person's face. And then she goes into the reconciliation or accommodation. So there were a number of accommodations that were proposed. Could you exclude all the men from the courtroom? That might not work because the accused has a right to counsel of their choice. So they might choose to have a man be their lawyer. And so, again, you're back to the same problem. Could you limit the exposure of that this woman would not have to show her face to everybody? Maybe she could testify from closed-circuit television. Maybe she can testify from a one-way screen. So these are all issues that the Chief Justice says, well, this is stuff that the preliminary judge or the trial judge can explore as ways of accommodation. But she admits, frankly, that maybe none of these really are real accommodations. Maybe they're just kind of minimizing the infringement. And then she talks about, okay, now we're going to weigh. This is like the moment that everyone's been waiting for. How do you weigh it? How do you weigh this? What's the balance? So she says, where a niqab is worn because of a sincerely held religious belief, a judge should order remove if the witness wearing the niqab poses a serious risk to trial fairness. There is no way to accommodate both rights, and the salutary effects of requiring the witness to remove the niqab outweigh the deleterious effects of doing so. And how do we assess the deleterious effects? Well, we assess them in two ways. On the micro level, the impact on the claimant. So how important is the practice to the claimant? What is the degree of state interference with the religious practice? So, strangely enough, even though we're not supposed to assess the strength of a religious belief when we're talking about the Section 2A analysis, here the strength of the belief comes into play. It does come into play because we're asking how important is this practice? So, oh, she admits to exceptions. Maybe this isn't so bad. And Justice Abella, in her dissenting reasons, takes issue with this. Justice Abella asks, well, how can you say that strength of belief is not important when you're assessing the infringement of her freedom of religion, but then somehow it is important now? And then the Chief Justice also says the deleterious effects, we also have to take into account the broader societal harms. So not just the impact on this particular claimant and the impact of the interference with her religious rights right here, but also broadly. So she acknowledges that this might lead to reluctance on the part of Muslim women who wear the niqab to report offenses and pursue prosecution. They might not come forward if they think that they are going to be forced to take off the niqab. And that is a harm that is caused to society in general. And then the salutary effects. The salutary effects are preventing harm to the fair trial interest of the accused and safeguarding the repute of the administration of justice. And here the Chief Justice talks about how the cost of an unfair trial is very severe. If these men have an unfair trial and are convicted based on an unfair trial, this puts our administration of justice into doubt. And she says, contrary to Justice Doherty, she says this is important even at a preliminary inquiry. She does not make the distinction between preliminary inquiry, trial, judge alone, jury trial. she doesn't think that this should be as big of a consideration. So, although this is all formulated as a balancing approach, I've pulled a few quotes from the reasons where I feel like the court is saying that the fair trial rights are going to trump freedom of religion. The Chief Justice writes, where evidence is uncontested, credibility assessment and cross-examination are not an issue. Therefore, being able to see the witness's face will not impinge on the accused's fair trial rights. Okay, so basically only where evidence is uncontested. So is that the only time she's going to be allowed to wear her niqab, and every time the evidence is contested, she's not? An important consideration will be the extent to which cross-examination and credibility assessment on the witness's testimony is central to the case. Well, here, in my view, I think it's probably going to be a pretty significant part of the case. At this point, however, it may be ventured that where the liberty of the accused is at stake, the witness's evidence is central to the case and her credibility vital. The possibility of a wrongful conviction must weigh heavily in the balance, favoring removal of the niqab. So in my view, even though we're laying out this framework, we're saying we're doing this balancing, I feel like the court is coming down more in favor of the removal of the niqab. And I also say that because Justice Fish joined this judgment. And at the hearing, he was very strong in his questioning about the rights to the accused. And so I feel like he might have only really joined this judgment if he felt that it respected those principles for him or endorsed them strongly enough. Justices LaBelle and Rothstein, they adopt a strict rule against wearing the niqab. And they base it on the broader values of Canadian democracy and the Canadian criminal justice system. And this is what the kind of the big part of their judgment. They talk about how the justice system accommodates people so that they can better participate in a trial. So blind or deaf litigants and parties of limited mobility take part in judicial proceedings. We accommodate them even though they are not able to take part fully. And they say, but wearing a niqab, on the other hand, does not facilitate acts of communication. Rather, it restricts them. It removes the witness from the scope of certain elements of those acts on the basis of the assertion of a religious belief in circumstances in which the sincerity and strength of belief are difficult to assess or even question. The niqab shields the witness from interacting fully with the parties, their counsel, the judge, and, where applicable, the jurors. And lastly, Justice Abella dissents, and in her judgment, she agrees with the first stage, the 2A analysis. She, as I mentioned earlier, she doesn't understand why the majority is critical of the strength of the religious belief when you're assessing the religious claim, but then it's relevant afterwards. She decides that a woman should be allowed to wear her niqab primarily because this would have a chilling effect on complainants in sexual assault cases. She's also critical of the reliance that we have on demeanor evidence. And there's a bunch of Court of Appeal decisions from across the country where judges are critical of demeanor evidence. And she also talks about how, in a lot of cases, demeanor can be difficult to observe. A lot of people are allowed to testify with the assistance of an interpreter. In that case, neither the judge nor the lawyers are, everything is translated. Maybe the vocabulary used is slightly different. There are also people who testify with medical or physical limitations, and there are principal exceptions to the hearsay rule. And lastly, Jezebela asks, in this case we have the accused, the complainant is the one who wears the niqab, but would there be a different outcome if the accused were the one who were wearing the niqab and she wanted to testify in her own defense? How would we do that analysis? And in my view, I'm not sure if you would have the same, you're not necessarily balancing things the exact same way. But that is an important consideration that the majority does not address and is only raised in Justice Abella's dissenting reasons. So that's it for me. Hopefully that gets you pretty well versed into the decision, and so that we can continue the discussion of the next speakers.
Un grand merci à Eva Krajewska. C'est toujours un plaisir de recevoir nos diplômés ici à la faculté. C'est, ça en était encore un ce soir.
So it's my pleasure to introduce you now, now my colleague, Professor Vrinda Narain, who has graciously accepted to participate in this continuing legal education series for the second time. Dr. Narain is an assistant professor at McGill, where she holds a joint appointment in the Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Arts in the Institute of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies. Professor Narain holds BA and an LLB degrees from the University of Delhi in India. She pursued graduate studies at McGill, obtaining here an LLM and a DCL degree. As a lawyer, she has practiced in the areas of constitutional law, administrative law, and family law. Today, she teaches and conducts research in the areas of constitutional law, feminist legal theory, social diversity in law, post-colonial studies in law, and critical race theory. She is the author of two books, Reclaiming the Nation, Muslim Women and the Law in India, 2008, and Gender and Community, Muslim Women's Rights in India, 2001. Please join me in welcoming Professor Vrinda Narain.
Thanks, Rosalie. Thanks, Vera, for organizing this. And thanks, Eva, for doing a brilliant job that now cuts my presentation time in half. So I don't want to speak too loudly, so I'm going to put it here. So I hope you like my title. It's called Veil Threats, The Place of the Niqab in the Courtroom. I thought that was quite clever, personally. Eva has told us all about the case from the trenches to the hallowed halls of the Supreme Court. What I'm going to do in the 40 minutes that I have is I'm going to talk about just the Supreme Court decision. I'm not going to go over the facts or any of those kinds of tedious details. We're going to stick to just theory. In my presentation, what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to focus on those aspects of the decision that relate only to the balancing of rights and the accommodation of difference. I'm going to look first at the majority opinion, and then I'll go on to consider briefly Justice LaBelle's opinion. Strangely enough, it's called a concurring opinion, but really it's a terrible dissent. It's in stark contrast to the reason. So he had the same conclusion. He sent the case back, or he would have sent the case back to the trial judge, but for completely, completely different reasons than the majority. And then I'm going to talk briefly about Justice Abella's real dissenting opinion, and I'll conclude with some observations on the future implications of this decision for religious minority claimants. So the first part is really called pragmatic judging or ducking the issue. So there are all kinds of controversies about how we can receive and read this majority opinion. So usually when I stand here before you, I'm the interpreter of certain dreadful practices. Today I decided I'd take a more sort of rational approach to things. I'd be kinder to the Chief Justice and think that maybe she had particularly good reasons and she had a very difficult job to do, balancing public policy objectives with the accommodation of religious difference. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to put the question to you. Did she make this decision? Was it really a matter of pragmatic judging, or did it really serve to duck the issue and then she sent it right back to where it started? So in determining how the state should respond to a witness who sincerely held religious belief requires her to wear a niqab, the court avoided, or the majority avoided, what was considered to be an extreme response. So rejecting the all-or-nothing response of Justice LaBelle, the Chief Justice crafted a framework that sort of blended the Oakes test with the Dagenais common law framework. And she used this approach to balance competing interests. And the context of this balancing was reasonable accommodation as well as the fair trial for the accused. So these were the questions that she framed as a result of that Dagenais mentor approach to balancing competing interests. Eva has already given that, so we're going to skip right over this slide. Okay. And what the majority decides is that first it looks at whether it is possible, is there a way to accommodate both rights and avoid the conflict between them? But if there is no accommodation possible, then do the salutary effects of removing the niqab outweigh the deleterious effects of forcing her to take it off? So whatever one might make of the final balancing, I think it is really a matter of some optimism that the majority rejected the sort of all-or-nothing approach and decided that it would, in certain circumstances, allow the witness to testify while wearing her niqab, unless it unjustifiably impinges on the fair trial rights of the accused. So, I'm going to go back to the last slide where it's interesting where she says that the answer is not, and I'm reading from the PowerPoint, it says, the answer is not to ban religion from the courtroom, transforming the courtroom into a neutral space where witnesses must park their religious convictions at the door. So here she's making a huge effort to accommodate religious minorities. Nor does it lie in ignoring the ancient and persistent connection the law has postulated between seeing a witness's face and trial fairness. So rather, the answer lies in a just and proportionate balance between freedom of religion on the one hand and trial fairness on the other, based on the particular case before the court. So now we've heard from Eva, and it is possible that maybe what was going through her mind, that really she's going to put fair trial up here, niqab down there, but we're going to give her the benefit of the doubt for the time being. Okay. So, what the Dagenais framework makes clear is that this is a proportionality analysis, and she says it's really akin to the last part of the Oakes test. And that's why she does this balancing act in terms of the Oakes test as well as balancing interests. So the question is, did the Supreme Court get it right this time? Is there some kind of hope for minority women, or is this majority opinion as well closing the door on the recognition of their rights? So she does say that if wearing the niqab poses no serious risk to trial fairness, a witness who wishes to wear it for sincere religious reasons may do so. Now, It seems that she's going through this in a methodical way. She's doing the balancing, she's considering all the implicated issues and rights, etc. It's also encouraging for minority women from the way in which she acknowledges the broader societal harms. Now, I was involved with LEAF as an intervener in this case from the very beginning, and we were one of the interveners that Eva mentioned that were not given leave to present arguments, so they just looked at our oral submissions at the Supreme Court stage. And one of the things that we found was that it seemed as if the Supreme Court was very hostile to niqab-wearing women. But here's what they have to say. Leaf is very chuffed that part of the submission did make its way into the Supreme Court decision, and here where it is. The acknowledgement of broader societal harms if women are forced to testify while removing their niqabs. So the majority notes that it's going to result in an exclusion of women who wear the niqab from the criminal justice system, that the wrongs perpetrated against them will remain punished. It was also encouraging to note that the majority opinion over here noted the specific context of sexual assault and the fact that it is an underreported crime. So these are the encouraging aspects of the decision for minority women. Encouragingly, she also says that despite the fact that it may be common law tradition to have this sort of open-faced trial, there is no reason not to question tradition. So what she says is that in recent decades, the justice system, recognizing the seriousness of sexual assault and the extent to which it is underreported, has vigorously pursued those who commit this crime. Laws have been changed to encourage women and children to come forward to testify, and myths that once stood in the way of conviction have been set aside. So all this is good stuff. And then she goes on to look at the salutary effects of removing the niqab, and that, of course, is the question of fair trial. And I'm not going to go into that because, unlike a lot of you here, I'm not a criminal law expert. So going on next to the question of reasonable accommodation, because this is a very important part of the decision. Did she make an effort, or did the majority really do the balancing in a way that was a reasonable accommodation of religious difference? So remember the Hutterian decision in which the Chief Justice was very keen not to think about reasonable accommodation. And she had good reasons for doing that, because she was concerned that reasonable accommodation was something that was conceptually or analytically distinct from a Section 1 test, because this was now legislation that was challenged and not an administrative regulation or a private arrangement between two individual parties. Anyway, so reasonable accommodation. Was this a reasonable accommodation? So it is noteworthy, in my opinion, that the majority reaffirmed the place of reasonable accommodation of religious practices in Canadian jurisprudence, and not just within private negotiations. So this was an important part. She made sure that there was a place for the niqab in the courtroom. So the public arena now becomes one of those areas in which there can be the accommodation of religious beliefs. What are the reasons that she gives us? She gives us three reasons for accommodating religious difference based on and drawing from Canadian jurisprudence. So first, she says, is our jurisprudence teaches that clashes between rights should be approached by reconciling the rights through accommodation if possible, and in the end, if a conflict cannot be avoided, by case-by-case balancing. So arguably, she might reach the conclusion in this case, balancing the interest, that NS should be allowed to wear the niqab. I think that she would have agreed. an absolute rule that courtrooms are secular spaces where religious belief plays no role would stand as a unique exception to this approach. And this may be a response to Justice LaBelle's argument that a courtroom is a neutral space, it's a secular space, and there can be no manifestation of religious belief. And this is something that we can discuss in the Q&A. The second reason she gives is that to remove religion from the courtroom is not Canadian tradition. And that's also very interesting for those of us who follow religious freedom cases. The third reason she gives is the need to accommodate and balance sincerely held religious belief against other interests as being deeply entrenched in Canadian law. So again, she's looking to precedent. And she has a fourth reason, and I've called this pragmatic compromise with a question mark. She says, this brings me to the final reason for rejecting an approach that would never allow a witness to testify while wearing a religious facial covering. It does not comport with the fundamental premise underlying the Charter that rights should be limited only to the extent that limits are shown to be justifiable. And here she's introducing the Oakes test, the minimal impairment and the balancing and the proportionality to her understanding of balancing under the Dagenais mental framework. So significantly, she's rejecting Justice LaBelle's assertion that there must be one rule, a blanket rule, that is always going to be applied, that there is no place ever for a niqab in the criminal law context. Now, it seems that what she's doing really in her balancing is that she says that competing rights should be reconciled if possible. If not possible, then you have to do it on a case-by-case basis. So the question that you might be thinking about is, what does this really mean? What would it mean for the resolution of this particular case? And of course, there's certain difficulties with her opinion. The first difficulty is that although it does seem to be doing this kind of rational, pragmatic compromise balancing, it doesn't fully consider the impact on the witness's religious freedom if she's forced to testify without her niqab. There's very little time that the majority opinion spends on looking at the impact in terms of religious freedom violations. The second difficulty is that while it considers the broader societal harms of forcing niqabi women to de-veil, the concrete impact is curiously glossed over. So we don't really get a sense about what it is that's going to happen when a woman is forced to remove the niqab while testifying. And this leads to the other part, the related issue, that she doesn't sufficiently contextualize the importance of the niqab to the witness. And maybe in this case we can think about, say, the Multani case, where they characterized the kirpan in a particular way, but there was no such time spent in this case on characterizing the niqab. Now, my point here is not to go into the significance of the niqab and what it means and it doesn't mean, and whether the religion allows it or doesn't allow it, and is there a part in the Quran that says you have to and another part that says you don't have to. So that's not the point really, and I think Amsalem may have settled that for us once and for all. At the same time, it seems that she doesn't fully consider the scope and content of what 2A really means. What is the right to religious freedom is not something that she goes into in any great detail. The other difficulty is that it doesn't seem to be sending a clear message out to the lower courts as to what priority is to be given to religious freedom and the accommodation of difference. And this is something that Eva talked about, is there really an implicit hierarchy of rights? Is there any kind of prioritizing that's going on? The last difficulty is that she doesn't fully consider the notion of meaningful choice, as pointed out by Justice Abella. If you think back to the Hatterian decision, a lot of it revolved around the idea of meaningful choice and the judgment by the Chief Justice that there was a meaningful choice in terms of either choosing to drive and get a license, or hiring a driver to do the driving job. So Justice Abella, again in that case, was in dissent and said this was not a meaningful choice. Let's go quickly now to the second part. The clash of civilizations approaches what I've called Justice LaBelle's dissent, the no place for multiculturalism in the courtroom opinion. So this is something we can think about. He dismissed the appeal and he would send it back, but of course, like I said before, for completely different reasons. And these reasons can be characterized as a clash of civilizations approach. His decision or his opinion was that a clear rule that niqabs may not be worn at any stage of the criminal trial would be consistent with the principle of public openness of the trial process and would safeguard the integrity of that process as one of communication. So he noted the fact that there was a rapidly changing diversity in Canadian society. But he reiterated that despite this rapidly changing diversity and the multiculturalism of Canada, any accommodation of difference has to be premised on or measured against core Canadian constitutional values. So on the face of it, it seems something one can't really challenge. But when you look at it a little bit closer, you can see that it has troubling implications for minority claimants and group rights claims as well. What Justice LaBelle does is he invokes a living tree doctrine, but insists that the framework within which a constitution can grow and recognize new social realities has to be on core Canadian values. And again, we can speculate about whether these core Canadian values are establishing a particular hierarchy of rights. Are we going to always privilege, say, gender equality over religious freedom? Is this something that we're interested in doing? The difficulty with this approach is that it underscores the limits of multicultural accommodation and the recognition of difference. It tells us that there are certain limits to it and difficulties with a full recognition. It also underscores the fact that the terms of recognition are going to be set by the majority or by measuring against majority norms. The next thing he does is he looks at the public-private binary and he seems to reinforce it, that there is a split between the public and the private. So whereas the majority opinion argues for the recognition within the courtroom of multicultural difference, he says very clearly the courtroom is a secular neutral place which should not be impinged on by private religious beliefs in effect. So here's what he says. Those common values are the ones that allowed Canada to develop and live as a diverse society. They preserve a public space where all will be welcome as they are. But you have to wonder as they are. But where some common core values will facilitate the interaction between all members of society. So this can be something that sends the chilling effect. He says that the religious neutrality of the state and of its institutions, including the courts and the justice system, protects the life and growth of a public space open to all, regardless of their beliefs, disbeliefs, and unbeliefs. Religions are voices among others in the public space, which includes the courts. So some of you might be questioning then, what is the scope and content of the guarantee of religious freedom as per Justice LaBelle's opinion? There are all kinds of difficulties again with this approach, which is the blanket approach or the nothing but one approach. What he says is that there is no place for the recognition of religious difference because the courtroom is a neutral space. Because the state is a secular state, there has to be a separation between the manifestation of private beliefs in a public space and what you do on your own private time. The difficulty is that By characterizing the ban on the niqab in this particular way as a rude interruption of the public-private divide, arguably is to misunderstand the long tradition of Canadian religious freedom jurisprudence that emphasizes a reasonable accommodation approach to competing rights, that advocates a minimal impairment analysis and justification for a limitation on the right to religious freedom. So he leaves no space for this consideration. His understanding also arguably narrows the scope of 2A guarantee and is based on an erroneous understanding of the meaning of neutrality and secularism and leaves little room for the accommodation of difference. Veronique, do I have time for Justice Abella? Excellent. So now I have come to the third part, the real dissenting opinion. What Justice Abella notes is that there is this swirling controversy in Canada around the niqab. Whether the niqab is mandatory for Muslim women or whether it marginalizes or oppresses the women who wear it. And this is the argument of the organization that Eva was representing, that it's a symbol of oppression. I'm not going to go into that here, but of course there's lots to say about that as well, the idea of agency and choice and false consciousness and rescuing women from their outdated barbaric laws. But the question is really, does the niqab or the accommodation of the niqab in the courtroom enhance multiculturalism or does it demean it? The approach that Justice Abella takes really is something that offers the most hope in terms of multicultural accommodation, in terms of recognizing the particular context of women who are victims or survivors of sexual assault and the intersectionality approach. So what she says is that the harmful effects of requiring a witness to remove her niqab, with the result that she will likely not testify or bring charges, is significantly more harmful than the accused not being able to see the witness's whole face. So again, this is a matter of debate. She also focuses on the exclusion of others and the notion of meaningful choice. And she says then that if you insist on asking women to remove the niqab to testify, they will be excluded from the criminal justice system. It also has the effect of forcing on NS, for example, to choose between her religious beliefs and her ability to participate in the justice system. And if you think of the Brooker Markovitz case, you'll see that Justice Abella was thinking about this at that time as well. The lack of meaningful choice. Same thing in her dissent in the Hutterian case. The lack of a meaningful choice. She also doesn't like the whole argument about sincerity versus strength. And this is something that it seemed that Chief Justice McLaughlin rejected, but then brought it up again. Does it mean that it has a new meaning then in terms of Absalom? Is it a new obstacle for religious freedom claimants to think about, that they have to have not just a sincere belief, but now somebody is going to measure the strength of it? So this is something that she doesn't agree with at all. And what she says is that to exclude niqabi women would be like hanging a sign on the courtroom door, religious minorities are not welcome here. So clearly her approach is more compatible with the view of accommodating multiculturalism. It's more accommodating of difference, but it's also based on a contextual approach. It also relies on Absalom's sincerely held belief as enough of a criterion or a test for religious belief. She looks at meaningful choice, and she considers as well the idea of inclusion and exclusion if you're not going to accommodate religious minorities within the courtroom as a public forum. She's also doing the contextual approach, which talks about the sexual assault aspect of the case, which is a very important aspect that we really need to be to keep in mind when we're deciding on whether or not she should be allowed to keep her niqab on. So in the few minutes that I have left, I want to just spend it quickly just listing out what are the future implications, because I think it's important for us to understand how we can place this decision or how we can situate this decision along the spectrum of other religious freedom cases. So the first idea is that, yes, in fact, there was a pragmatic balancing in terms of the rights claims. The majority opinion did recognize the necessity of contextualizing rights and the broader societal harms, but it really didn't seem to get too far. There were some difficulties in questioning the strength of her belief versus the sincerity, and is this now an extra burden for religious freedom claimants? There was a lack of a minimal impairment analysis if you think about the majority opinion. It's unclear what the majority decision portends then for minority religious groups who are seeking exemptions from the application of general secular rules. And does it mean that the court is not going to be sympathetic to such claims and that the threshold for the claimant is set impossibly high? So I think my PowerPoint has ended it for me. Thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to your questions.
I'd like to thank our first two speakers, but as you know, this is not yet over. We certainly have more speakers to come after the break. So we'll take a 15-minute break now, and if you could return by 7:45, that would be great. Thank you.
Check 1, 2. Check.
Could we all take our seats so we can continue the program? Welcome back. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce our final speaker this evening, who will give us a criminal lawyer's take on this judgment, Maître Isabelle Sherman. Now, a great part of my pleasure in introducing her derives from the fact that we were classmates together in law school here at McGill, and as such, Isabelle is someone I have known and admired for a very long time. Isabelle graduated from the Faculty of Law with her BCL and LLB, having been awarded the prestigious Scarlet Key Award on graduation, an award that recognizes outstanding student leadership. She has been practicing law, in particular criminal law, since 1984, and is today with the firm that bears her name, Sherman Longo Grenier. Her professional abilities have been recognized by the Quebec Bar Association, which honored her as Advocatus Emeritus in 2009, and by the American College of Trial Lawyers, where she was named a fellow in 2010. Her legal community service has been extensive. She has served with the National Criminal Law Section of the Canadian Bar Association, holding the position of chair from 98 to 2000. She is vice chair of the Canadian Council of Criminal Defense Lawyers. She was a member of the Council of the Bar of Montreal and has served on numerous Montreal Bar Association criminal justice committees. She is also a member of the Quebec Bar Association Cultural Communities Committee, on the board of directors of SOCIJ, serving as its vice president since 2011, and a member of the board of directors and vice president of Éducalois since 2009. See, there was so much there, I had to catch my breath. She has been a member of the Legal Aid Liaison Committee of the Canadian Bar Association, and she has served on the Montreal Defense Lawyers Association Council. She was also a member of the Board of Directors of the Quebec Bar Association Foundation from 1997 until 2002. In addition to her full-time practice and extensive community involvement, and believe me, I left out a few things, Maître Sherman somehow finds the time to give back to her alma mater by teaching here in the faculty as a sessional lecturer in evidence and sentencing. And her teaching doesn't end at McGill. In 2004 and 2005, she participated in a continuing legal education program in China, and she has taught at or given conferences for l'Université de Montréal, Concordia University, and the Quebec Bar School, as well as for the National Judicial Institute and the Canadian Institute for the Administration of Justice. A graduate of my class of 1983, boy, they made them good in those days, please welcome Isabelle Sherman.
Thank you very much, Rosalie. Bonsoir tout le monde. Il me fait bien, bien plaisir de t'inviter ici ce soir. I want to thank my two former, if we can call them, panelists for those excellent presentations. I must say I'm a little intimidated as I am here only to give you the point of view of what someone I know well has always referred to me as a simple criminaliste. So I will not pretend to have the depth of knowledge of my two co-panelists, but I'm thrilled that we could benefit from that before I say a few perhaps more lighter notes on this judgment. First of all, though, when Belmal was talking about the incident with the English barristers and solicitors, it was in fact in 1988. And they were having their annual convention, and yes, they were having it at Euro Disney because they couldn't find a place big enough, they said, in London. But one of their preoccupations was the fact that the European human rights legislation was going to come into force and was promising to give judges in England the power to perhaps do what judges were beginning to do in Canada, that is to say, to strike down certain laws or to decide certain provisions would be inoperative. They were generally, if I had to use one word to explain the overall feeling amongst the English barristers and solicitors, it was horrified. They were horrified because they were scared. They said certainty is essential to our system. Now, how are we going to offer anybody certainty if a judge might just slap down the law in the course of the proceedings? But our choice here has been not to choose certainty at any price, and if you want to read some interesting materials on it, I know that David Pachoco, author and now judge in Ontario, has written some interesting material on why we don't want to choose certainty at any price. This judgment of the Supreme Court would appear to me to be one that doesn't choose certainty. And maybe there are good reasons for it, and maybe we'll all hear some of your feelings about it during the question and answer. On my way back from court today, and if I seem a little less prepared in some parts of this presentation, you'll have to attribute it to the fact that I've been in court constantly and so maybe didn't have things quite the way I want them for tonight. But on my way back from court, I spoke with a cab driver who, I happened to get this driver who was driving when I started practicing with Legal Aid in 1984, and he drives from the courthouse since, and I happened to get him tonight, and I said, you know, I'm going to listen to some people talk about if a woman is accusing a man of a crime and she believes in wearing a niqab and her face is covered except her eyes, should she be able to testify with her niqab? What do you think about that? I'm a great believer in the wisdom of cab drivers. I think that it's something that we really shouldn't overlook. And he replied, he said to me, well, we've got to make sure she goes through with it. We've got to make sure she goes to court, and we've got to make sure he's convicted. Now, you might imagine I have a problem with part of that statement, but it does illustrate exactly what we're dealing with here. How do we get her to go to court, so the Section 2 interests and the freedom of religion rights, and how do we make sure that he's only convicted on properly tested evidence? And that's really what the court was trying to struggle with. I don't have as many big issues with the way they came down middle of the road, but with certain advice for trial judges in the future. There was a time when it seemed that every Supreme Court of Canada judgment that came out talked about some basic organizing principle of one kind or another. The one I really like is the presumption of innocence. The presumption of innocence is the basic organizing principle of the criminal law and of criminal process. It's the basis of the rules of criminal process in this country. It's the explanation behind procedural and constitutional protections. And if you were to presume the accused guilty, most of the stuff we listen to lectures about and debate about wouldn't even be necessary. It's necessary because you presume the accused is innocent. And the accused is being prosecuted by the state. The whole weight of the state and its agents against one accused. Goliath against David. And David is presumed innocent. The Section 7 protections, the due process protections, the rules of evidence, for example, which exclude the use of character evidence against an accused. The rules designed to ensure that evidence is relevant to the charge and that it's limited to the charge, that the criminal trial does not become the general trial of a man or woman's life. The right to remain silent, just to name a few. These are all representations of rules that came about because of our right to remain silent. One of those rules which enjoys constitutional protection in the United States is the right to confront one's accuser, the right to face one's accuser. That particular right does not enjoy constitutional status in Canada, but you see in one of the judgments of the Supreme Court, Leo Giovannis, where they talk about the situation in the United States, that in the United States Constitution and numerous state constitutions, the accused is guaranteed the right to confront witnesses testifying. So the debate in the United States has been on a slightly different basis because the right to face one's accuser has a constitutional status. It's seen as a fundamental, I mean, even if it, okay, no, let me just back up. Sorry. It doesn't have constitutional status here in Canada, and that was also clear in Leo Giovannis. But there was a judgment in Nova Scotia a couple of years back where Justice MacDonald of the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal said something that may be shaping our future. And he said, the right to face one's accusers is not, in this day and age, to be taken in the literal sense. In my opinion, it is simply the right of an accused to be present in court to hear the case against him and to make full answer in defense. So it's not constitutional. It may be not so clear as it was in the past. But the debate isn't just about or doesn't stop at, is this about making witnesses comfortable? Because the reality is that witnesses have never been comfortable in courtrooms. And I quote Justice Gove in a case called Forster, decided in British Columbia in 2006. Now, he said, I think it may be trite to say, but the practice in criminal courts going back over the centuries is if witnesses testify in public, the person accused is present in the courtroom. And witnesses, I dare say, over the centuries, are often nervous, do not want to see the person they have accused, and frankly, do not want to testify. Witnesses are going to be stressful, whichever way you look at it, and the debate can't be simple enough to stop at what is going to make the witness more comfortable. Now, in Canada, it's not seen as constitutional, but it's seen as fundamental, if you will, that if a man or a woman's freedom is at stake, if they risk the stigma of a criminal conviction, their ability to see their accuser is fundamental, not necessarily confront. Canadian courts have struggled with the status of this right to face the accuser, and this is as far as we've come. And in Canada, in fact, the laws of evidence began to change in 1988. They changed in 1988, the criminal code, I mean to say, excuse me, in terms of whether the accused would always be confronting his accuser. There were changes in 1988, changes in 1994, changes in 1997, all of which came about in an attempt to accommodate vulnerable witnesses, to make sure that we don't lose witnesses' testimony. All of these led to debates in the courts about whether or not these infringed on the right of the accused. And all of them have been upheld uniformly in Canada, where the right to face one's accuser has been found not to be absolute, but rather a right which is subject to qualification in the interests of justice. So that you see the introduction of, for example, screens, closed-circuit television. You see the introduction of various ways of proceeding where the accused can see the witness, the accused counsel can see the witness, but the witness does not necessarily see the accused. And all of these have been upheld as long as the court can see the witness and the accused can see the witness. And that's where the difference comes in with what's going on in the case that you're studying this evening. So, if the right to face an accuser is not constitutional, then why is this NS case seen as a constitutional face-off? Because that's what it is seen as. And it's because the court doesn't concentrate on the right to face the accuser, but on the accused's fair trial rights in virtue of 7 and 11D of the Charter, which the court refers to, 7 and 11D, as inextricably intertwined. And the court first looks at, and I'm not going to go back over what my colleagues have done better than I can do it, but first looks at religious freedom, will removing the niqab interfere with the witness's religious freedom? The comment I have to say on that is when the court talks about wanting to focus on sincerity rather than strength of belief, I have no idea what they're talking about. I find it extremely difficult to think what is the evidence going to be of sincerity and what is the evidence going to be of strength. When does strength become insincere? When does sincerity turn out to be weakness or false? I found it very difficult, as they say in the vernacular, to get my head around. How would you make evidence of sincerity or strength, and where is the line, and are these real lines they've drawn, or are they somehow artificial ones? My colleagues would probably be far more qualified than I am to go any further on that. The next question the court encourages trial courts to look at is, would the permitting the niqab create serious risk to trial fairness? They talk about how the importance of seeing a face of a witness, and it's the same for the accused, is deeply rooted. It's a presumption in our system that the court refers to as deeply rooted, that you presume you're going to see the witness's face. And the court was manifestly concerned with the fact that it did not have any evidence before it that would permit it to say that we may now reject this, what they call, deeply rooted presumption. They say it more than once in the decision, that we just don't have evidence before us, has not shown this presumption to be unfounded or erroneous. They do leave a kind of a little door open, if it's not just a window, that maybe someday in the future such evidence might be available to perhaps give more weight to the argument that, you know, seeing the facial features or the facial reactions is really not that important. But the court does go on to decide that all of these are going to have to be decided, as my colleagues have told you, on a case-by-case basis, to decide whether the inability to see the witness's face threatens trial fairness in a particular case. And it will depend on the evidence in that particular case. And they give the example that if the evidence is uncontested, then there's going to be, and there's no credibility assessment, and there's no, and cross-examination is not a big deal of that particular witness, well, then there won't be an issue. And I was thinking about, for example, the archivist from a hospital who comes to file medical records and you know, while she's on the stand, wants to wear the niqab. Well, I understand that there's not going to be any issue there, but no defense counsel in the world is going to raise it either. You know, it's going to be raised in cases where there's a question that it could perhaps impede unfair trial rights. This was the page I was looking for earlier, you see, and I couldn't find it. I went by memory, and I think I got everything. I'm so sorry. So when there's no serious risk to trial fairness, the witness can wear the niqab, but as I say, I doubt there'd ever be an issue anyway. The objections concerning trial fairness before the Supreme Court are the ones that the judges are considering, boil down to preventing cross-examination. Will the wearing of the niqab prevent cross-examination or interfere with the ability of the trier of fact to assess credibility? Interestingly enough, it seems to me, unless I really misread all these, you know, I have a lot of trouble when all these decisions are just letters and there are no names anymore, but if I didn't misread it, the Crown and the accused are on the same side in the debate before the Supreme Court. And that was kind of interesting, but I think both erring on the side of the traditional view of the criminal justice trial and the fear that we must look at, we must be conscious of, are we preventing effective cross-examination or are we interfering with the ability of the trier of fact to assess credibility? The court does talk about how communication is more than just words, and if I have my copy of the decision here... rightfully so, that's the Court of Appeal, talks about how communication is more than just words. If you bear with me for a moment, I'm sorry. Communication involves, this was the argument of of one of the accused and the Crown, who were arguing that the link was clear between effective cross-examination and effective assessment of a witness's credibility. They were seen as tied together. And at paragraph 18, the court says, communication involves not only words but facial cues. A facial gesture may reveal uncertainty or deception. The cross-examiner may pick up on nonverbal cues and use them to uncover the truth. Credibility assessment is equally dependent not only on what a witness says but on how she says it. Effective cross-examination and accurate credibility assessment are central to a fair trial. It follows, the Crown and the accused argued, that permitting a witness to wear a niqab may deny an accused fair trial rights. And the thing that came to my mind when we talk about communication being more than words is a classic and true story in the criminal justice milieu involving a judge who is now thankfully retired, sitting with a jury who, when he was telling the jury, well, you know, you've heard the theory of the Crown, and here are the Crown witnesses, and here's what they say, and you've heard the theory of the defense, and then turned to the jury and rolled his eyes. I mean, it's true that communication is more than words. Interveners and NS argued that the importance of the face has been exaggerated. that we still have the person's eyes, we still have their tone of voice, we still have the rhythm of their speech, and facial expressions are only a detail. Now, it has been said, and by courts in this country, that credibility assessment, and here it is, the assessment of credibility of a witness is more of an art than a science. And I think that's probably quite true. In that sense, I think both positions are probably quite right. The positions taken on the side of all the parties before the Supreme Court are probably all somewhat correct in what they say. The credibility assessment was the subject of some comments by Justice Abella in her decision, and she said something that kind of bothered me. And she said, how did she put it? I don't want to misquote her. She said, you know, she's the one who comes down in favor of a rule where the witness could wear the niqab all the time, except if identity of the witness is an issue. It's not that often that identity of the witness is an issue. It's usually identity of the accused might be an issue. This being said, but she did say something, I can't find the exact quote, but she said, certainly it would be easier to do the credibility assessment with the whole package. But if you don't have the face, it's okay. You're not really, you know, basically going to miss that much is the sort of sense of what she's saying. And I disputed the use of the word easier with the whole package. Credibility assessment, and I think Bernard will be able to answer questions on that during the question and answer period from a judge's perspective, but credibility assessment, with very few exceptions, is rarely easy. It's not a question of it being easier with the whole package. The question is there one piece of the package that might offer one detail, that might offer one person a fair trial? Is there one piece of the package? Because it doesn't have to be the balance of the package, for those of you who are civil lawyers in the room here, it doesn't have to be the whole package. The proof beyond a reasonable doubt means if the accused is entitled to whatever doubt the court may have. And if there's one piece of that package that might have contributed to the raising of a doubt, then as defense counsel, our position is that we can't afford to say that any part of the package could be missing if there's a possibility that one piece could contribute to a just decision. Now, the notions of how we go about evaluating credibility are also kind of interesting because, again, I think nobody was totally right and nobody was totally wrong at the Supreme Court, which is why they came out with this middle-of-the-road decision. But the way we assess credibility, and I'm looking back to a case decided in 1947, which is as good today as it was then, a case of White that talks about what are the factors, testimonial factors for a judge to consider. And White talks about in assessing credibility and reliability of a witness, the court will look at factors such as demeanor, recollection, communication, sincerity, prior inconsistencies, reasonableness of testimonies. So when you think about it, what do those mean? Demeanor, recollection. The only one that really might be affected is demeanor, by the fact that you can't see the rest of the face. Although maybe sincerity, but that's hard. So that kind of falls into demeanor as well. And we have to keep in mind that demeanor has never been approved by our courts of appeal or our Supreme Court of Canada as a standalone reason to reject any witness's testimony. Demeanor in and of itself is not sufficient. It's been decided, amongst others, by the Alberta Court of Appeal and several other courts. But what the Ontario Court of Appeal has said is that if a court decides on demeanor alone, it's a reversible error. So the Ontario Court of Appeal has said that, and has also said that reasonableness is more important than demeanor. But no court in Canada has said that demeanor is irrelevant. And that's the other side of that. Demeanor may not be enough in and of itself, but if there's a rule that says that the niqab is worn in every situation, in every circumstance, are we setting a rule that perhaps would go too far to removing the possibility that demeanor can be part of a package of elements, if you will, in some circumstances. Demeanor is something that a judge is entitled to consider in this country, although to a limited extent, but a judge is entitled to consider demeanor in assessing credibility. And we have all kinds of jurisprudence that's talked about things in our courts of appeal, like can a judge find a witness inherently unreliable? Can you draw an inference just from demeanor? What about the accused who won't make eye contact with the court? Is a judge allowed to comment on that? That's been the subject of debate in courts where the courts have said no, it's inappropriate for a judge to decide based only on the fact that the accused appeared too passive. But a judge is still allowed to give a jury instruction in this country to jurors that they are entitled to take into account the accused's demeanor while testifying. And one would think that, I'm not aware of any cases in Canada where an accused is asked to testify wearing a niqab, but one would presume that whatever rules we're developing here are going to apply perhaps across the board one day, so maybe we should be thinking about this as well. We're going to give an instruction to a jury saying that you're allowed to assess the accused's demeanor, but the jury will be unable to see more than what was stated in the court, the eyes, the tone of voice, and the rhythm of the speech. Don't know the answers to these things, but they're some of the questions that are raised when we look at our traditional approach to looking at credibility. I'm going to stop on that one now because I have something else to say. I did have a couple of more comments on the Supreme Court decision, but I'm afraid I'm going to run out of time. So what I'm going to do now is deal with two little things. They're not that little, actually. In the Ontario Court of Appeal, they're short, but not little. In the Ontario Court of Appeal decision, I'm not finished yet. In the Ontario Court of Appeal, the court dealt with something I thought was pretty important for those of you who are practitioners in criminal law, particularly in today's context in the Court of Quebec. Because one of the issues that came up was the judge at the preliminary hearing had no jurisdiction to make any order here because these were competing charter rights, and a judge at the preliminary hearing is not a court of competent jurisdiction under the charter, under Section 24. And the reason I say it's interesting in the context of today in the province of Quebec, we routinely have Crown prosecutors objecting to the questioning of police officers at preliminary hearings when we want to ask questions about the grounds upon which they requested the issuance of a search warrant or a wiretap authorization. And we all know that the judge at the preliminary hearing is not the one we're going to ask to exclude the evidence from the wiretap or the search warrant, but we'd like to be able to use the preliminary hearing for one of the purposes for which we still have it, and that is to explore possible defenses at trial. And routinely you get judges in the city of Montreal who unfortunately are saying, well, the Crown is right, I have no power under the charter, so I'm not going to allow those questions. Any of you who have that problem, get the Ontario Court of Appeal decision in this case, because it really is, it's excellent what they do. They talk about this argument, and they talk about the basis upon this argument was made. They agreed that a preliminary inquiry judge has no remedial jurisdiction under the charter, so that the judge can't exclude under 24. But they do not agree, and say very vehemently so, that a preliminary inquiry judge has no jurisdiction to consider and balance charter values when exercising statutory powers granted to the preliminary inquiry judge. And what they say is that they say a preliminary inquiry judge has the power to make sure that the proceedings that take place in his or her courtroom are just. They quote the sections of the criminal code under which the preliminary inquiry judge has these powers. They talk about the common law powers to ensure that what happens in that courtroom is fair and is just. And they said that there are so many situations where a preliminary inquiry judge is going to have to look at the competing charter values in order to make the order under the criminal code. And they give as an example a judge who is allowed to, for example, decide that a person is improperly dressed in his or her courtroom. And if the person says, well, I'm not improperly dressed, but I wear this for religious reasons, the Ontario Court of Appeal says the preliminary hearing judge is allowed to hear the arguments on the constitutional issues which are concerned by the decision he or she has to make. And I think it's a very interesting decision because it's an opening for us in the practice in criminal law to be able to say, well, it's not so cut and dried. Because there's no remedial jurisdiction under 24 doesn't mean that a preliminary hearing judge can never hear that in his or her courtroom there are competing charter interests that are involved in a decision he or she has to make in the interest of justice. And they give some examples, and some of them involve when judges order these new testimonial aids, having the witness testify by closed circuit TV or having the witness testify by audio link or things like that. And they talk about the fact that in those circumstances, there will often be competing charter values, and the preliminary hearing judge is entitled to listen to those arguments. So I thought that you might find it kind of interesting. I had asked the others if they thought that perhaps we might want to spend just a couple of minutes to point that out, because they really have gone a long way to clarify that it's not because a judge is sitting at a preliminary hearing that they cannot hear charter arguments if those are important to a decision that judge is obliged to render. Funny enough, they give another example of a witness who might ask that his cross-examination be interrupted so he can attend a religious service. And if the accused objects, then the judge would have to hear charter arguments on that. Very similar, the religion versus the fair trial. And I do believe, and I still believe and always will, that it still remains open to defense counsel to plead that the right to cross-examine thoroughly at the preliminary hearing is very much a part of the fair trial. The only basis upon we managed to save whatever was saved of the preliminary hearing was the eventual acknowledgement that the right to cross-examine certain witnesses was in fact essential to a just outcome in criminal trials. So that was one thing I wanted to say about the Ontario Court of Appeal decision. The other was just a question or food for thought for all of you. At some point, I think it's Justice Doherty, or I don't remember anyway, talks about the fact that if the defense contention is that the wearing of the niqab impairs cross-examination, it is incumbent upon the defense to establish those claims. Likewise, I think the Supreme Court makes some mention, but they don't go this far, but makes some mention about it being incumbent, or I think it's one of the minority judgments of the Supreme Court, it being incumbent upon the defense to show how the wearing of the niqab is going to impair on the right to a fair trial. How do I do that? I mean, how am I going to ever be able to do that? How am I going to show a fair trial is compromised before the trial begins? Suppose I have a case where there's no motive. Suppose I'm not dealing with ex-spouses who detest each other or with allegations of false sexual assault claims for some other purpose. Suppose I don't have one of those cases. How are we ever going to be able to show that it's going to impede the fair trial when the trial has not yet begun, when there's no apparent motive? Sometimes the real motivation of a witness is only evident after a long cross-examination. And what can the court assess, amongst other things, demeanor? But how am I going to make that evidence? The onus being on an accused to demonstrate that the fair trial is compromised. Some of the things that went through my mind were, if the witness has an interest, I have a chance. Maybe if the witness has a motive to lie, a motive to fabricate. But the Ontario Court of Appeal has told us in the past that it does not logically follow that because there is no apparent reason for a witness to lie, the witness must be telling the truth. So what do I do in a case like that? Where there's no apparent reason for the witness to lie, how am I going to prove that my fair trial rights are going to be affected? I would respectfully submit that that's a real tough uphill climb that few of us would be able to meet in cases where the evidence is just not there. That's done. The last two things I wanted to say were one thing about miscarriage of justice and one thing about the approach chosen by the Supreme Court, and then I'll sit down. Is that good? We're good? Okay, good. We have gone through years of collective guilt about a traditional criminal justice system which did not encourage the reporting of sexual offenses and did not facilitate testimony by the young. For a long, long time, our children were not being heard and our children were not being believed. To attempt to remedy this, we relaxed hearsay rules, we promoted testimonial aids to shield vulnerable witnesses. The witnesses no longer have to see the accused in a multitude of cases. We almost saw the end of the preliminary inquiry as a result of this, and we incorporated into our criminal justice system the notion of the search for the truth. Not that our traditional criminal justice system had been the search for a lie, but it had concentrated on the purpose being that the state has accused, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and proceedings must be fair. Now we're on a new playing field, and on this new playing field, we must be ever conscious of the risk of miscarriage of justice in this country. The reality is that miscarriage of justice is a reality in this country. We are the people who brought you Marshall, Milgaard, Truscott, Dumont, Jean Passe. We have nothing to be proud of. Various commissions have been set up to look at miscarriage of justice in this country, and they've pointed to various problems which lead to miscarriage of justice. False confessions, tunnel vision of police investigations, limiting the accused's access to evidence, limiting the accused's ability to test the evidence. Now on this new playing field, we must bend some of the traditional rules, and we have been bending them, but the search for the truth must not be framed in such a way that we can no longer identify the lie. There's no fluke that early on in the reasons paid by the reasons given by the majority, they pay attention to the risk of wrongful conviction. Wrongful convictions are a reality and certainly no less present in cases involving sexual abuse allegations, violence allegations between ex-spouses, criminal accusations between family members. It's one person's word often against another, and the presumption of innocence applies in these cases as well. That's my word of caveat, and my word of conclusion would be just to point out something interesting in the approach, well, I think it's interesting, it may not be at all, that the Supreme Court of Canada took in this case. Coming down the road, they came with the balancing suggestion that it's going to be, each case will be a different case, and each case will be evaluated on its own evidence, and putting back the responsibility with the trial judges, but making enough comments, as the prior speaker noted, enough comments to say, we reaffirm traditional, that we acknowledge traditional wrongs towards women who are victims of sexual crimes, we reaffirm the necessity for people to report, et cetera. So there's enough reaffirming that goes on in the decision to provide some sort of parameters for trial judges. And the reaffirmation of reasonable accommodation, there's enough reaffirming to give trial judges some basis upon which to render their decision. And it is true to some extent that each case will probably be a different balance based on different facts. But it's also true that the rule in Canada is that from all of our courts of appeal and our Supreme Court of Canada, that when a trial judge has decided a question of fact or credibility, the Court of Appeal should defer to the trial judge. So is the Supreme Court trying to ensure that we don't get many more of these going up the ladder? Is the Supreme Court trying to make sure that, listen, we'll just rely on the rule of deference from now on? We've given them the parameters. We've given them what they need. They'll render their decisions, and the Courts of Appeal will just say we defer. I don't know. I don't know what the answer will be, but it is something to be considered that by putting it back with trial judges, and it is a question of fact in each case, many of these cases will not necessarily get much higher, except if some of the counsel in those cases have access to the presentations of my former panelists talking about those issues which seem to remain unresolved, and they might be the ticket into a court of appeal in a future case. So those are my few comments. I thank you for your attention, and thank you.
Thank you so much, Isabel. Actually, if I could just ask our three panelists and our president d'honneur to come to this table. They have graciously agreed to do a joint Q&A, and I'm sure that the presentations here tonight have generated a lot of interest and I'm sure a lot of questions on your behalf. I've already received a few during the break, so that'll get us going while a few of you are writing out some more questions. And also, if you're in this room, feel free to raise your hand. But as I said, I certainly have a few to get us going before we need to get more. Okay, I will. And for the benefit of those of you in the breakout room, I will do my best to repeat in a succinct way as possible some of the questions. Okay, we'll start over here. Go ahead. Okay, let me just repeat the question briefly for those in the breakout room. The question is essentially, one of the intervenants, the Muslim Council of Canada, essentially asserts that the niqab is not a religious issue. If the Supreme Court had indeed accepted that it's not a religious issue, then we wouldn't have this decision that we have by the Supreme Court. Is that true? Who would like to tackle that? Maybe Ava.
I'll start. The Muslim Canadian Congress intervened at the Ontario Court of Appeal, and the applicant actually brought a motion for us to lose our intervener status. And there was a bit of a fight on that, and Justice Doherty allowed us to intervene at the Court of Appeal. And then we also intervened at the Supreme Court. I think in general, the Muslim Canadian Congress does take the position that the niqab isn't mandated by Islam, but it didn't take that position at the Supreme Court directly. It advocated for the Supreme Court to develop a more rigorous approach when considering a person's freedom of religion, that the inquiry should go further than just accepting that a practice is motivated for religious reasons, and that the inquiry should go into whether the practice might be motivated for cultural reasons or from pressure from, in this case, a husband or the family or in other ways. I don't think the Supreme Court has accepted that perspective in the way that I read the decision. In my view, ever since Amsalem, which is the case about Orthodox Jews who wanted to have sukkots on their balconies, and in that case, there were competing expert opinions from rabbis as to whether that is a legitimate religious practice. And in Amsalem, Justice Iacobucci just said, the court should not go there. The court should not become an arbiter of religious dogma. And they've followed that precedent since then.
Okay, I have another question here. Professor Beverly Baines from Queens, came to speak at the Faculty of Law here on this decision several weeks ago. And one of her criticisms of the Supreme Court of Canada decision is that the Supreme Court chose a balancing approach, balancing freedom of religion versus the right to a fair trial, as opposed to what the Supreme Court normally does in alleged charter infringement cases, namely the Section 1 Oakes test. And her assertion is that had they apply the Section 1 OPS test, which requires one to show that the infringement of a freedom, in this case freedom of religion, must be justified in a free and democratic society, would have had a different outcome on the case, or it would have been at least a different level of test that would have had to be met. And I'm just curious from our panelists if you think that that is actually true, if you think that the court should have gone the Section 1 route. If the court had gone the Section 1 route, would it be a different outcome? How do you react to that argument? Isabel's burning to speak.
I'm not exactly going to answer where I think they should have gone, but it wasn't surprising that they went where they did, because since Dajne Menchak, they've taken that balancing approach when dealing with issues of public trials, when dealing with all of the testimonial aids that were contested, like the screens, the witnesses testifying behind a screen by closed circuit television. Anything decided after Dajne was decided in the prism put forward by Dajne. So it's not, I'm not saying that I can answer your question as to whether they should or should not have used the OAKS test, but I was not surprised that they used the test they did.
Does anybody else want to intervene? Renta?
I think that what she did actually was that she combined the two. So if you look at just the majority opinion, what they did was they started off with the Dajne framework and then they talk about Section 1 as well. So in effect, really, they combined the two. So I don't think that they would have reached a different outcome. I think that they probably would have come to the same conclusion. And they did use the OAKS test as well.
Yes, absolutely, Eva.
I think the Section 1 OAKS test was developed in the context of when you're challenging a law or a provision. Here you're not challenging that. The first part of the OAKS, as everybody forgets, is that is the thing prescribed by law. Here we don't, we're not really dealing with a legal rule legislated by Parliament. But I think at the end of the day, all of the balancing acts or tests that the court has developed, whether it's the OAKS test or the remedy from under Section 24(2) in Grant or the Dajne Menchak test, all of them are informed by some kind of a proportionality analysis. And I think that's really where most of the work is done. And I'm not sure if the outcome would have been different. I think it's really what do you plug into the proportionality analysis.
Okay. Someone during the break gave me a written question, so I'm going to give that one priority, and then I'm going to go to a question in the audience. But this is actually something that I was thinking of when I was listening to the presentations. Has any other country faced this? Has this occurred in any other court? Is this something that has only arisen in Canada? Are we unique, or has other places, can we learn from other places? That was what I was thinking, but actually this particular question is focused on Muslim women in India, and the question is, are Muslim women in India with 100 million Muslims allowed to testify wearing the niqab? So maybe someone may want to answer it in the narrow senses with respect to a country that has a lot of Muslim women, or maybe in the broader sense as to whether this has happened anywhere else in the world and we can learn from it, or anybody?
For the answer, I think that, there is a case from New Zealand, I think it's called Razam Ju is the case. A lot of the cases are from the European Court of Human Rights as well. There should be many cases coming from India, but I have to say that there are none that I know of. And maybe because we're more ruthless in India about saying, sorry, if you want to vote, you need to take off the veil. So I don't myself know. I'll be happy if someone in the audience, I see a hand up there who probably has a case from India. I don't know.
Okay, question here, please.
That allowing her to wear the veil would impair her ability to use the needle. First, about the how much question, the evidence question, isn't there a risk that lawyers, when we calculate the admission, will ask it not only about effect of evidence on guilt, but also evidence of admission on their chance of fighting the possibility that she was a day, turning a one-day trial into a three-day trial because there's no admission, which, because those cases are likely to be mediatized because they are rare, would do the opposite of what the court wanted, because it would send the message to all 90% of the complainant that they are not believed, because even if there's a publication ban that includes a lawyer from just telling the jurors, well, we challenge the sincerity, so we don't want them to be evaded. So which would send the message that they are not believed.
So sorry, could you just give a very succinct question? I'm even losing the train. And I have to repeat it, so I need it.
The first part was how are judges going to handle this? And second, about the evidence. But then, you know, it's not only the evidence. We use it sometimes to gauge if it's dangerous to continue a certain line of question. How are we going to ever prove this without revealing in advance not only our defense, but almost the very content of our questions. And some of that would be treated offensive as if they were clients.
Okay, I think we're running away with things here. I'm not 100% sure what your precise question is, but maybe I'll use it as an opportunity to ask Bernard Grenier, from the perspective of a judge, how this all seems, right? Sort of if we've looked at this, maybe I'll sort of turn your question and put it to...
have to go to the bathroom.
But is it for a religious reason? I'm sorry, I don't think we can let you leave here until I balance your right to go to the bathroom with our right to hear you.
Not sure I understood your question completely, sir, but I'm sorry, it's probably my poor understanding. It's the balancing... is probably the most difficult part of a judgment dealing with a situation like this because, like as you said, Isabel said, what is sincere, what is strength, and so forth and so on. And when the charter was adopted and when we realized that it was going to change something, I used to say that the charter now requires from judges to be philosophers, sociologists, jurists, and so forth and so on, and all we have is a law degree. So it's very difficult. I retired 10.5 years ago, and I didn't have to apply this judgment because it was rendered last year, but I'm glad I'm not sitting anymore. I'm not sure I've answered your question properly, but it's very difficult. But again, what's interesting is that I was saying in my little presentation that some countries have adopted laws that categorically say no niqab, no this, no that. We've adopted a more sophisticated and a more balanced approach, which probably makes this country livable.
Isabel.
Two things you mentioned, and one of them is, the simple fact that a debate on this kind of issue is going to make a one-day trial into a five-day trial means that realistically, in cases where there can be some suggestion made and something done, defense counsel will be doing it, because no one wants their criminal trial to be extended over something that is a peripheral issue to some extent. But if there is an accommodation that can be constructed or made in light of what the Supreme Court said, they've given some tools there to look for what can be done. The other thing is, on your business about the defense counsel having to reveal defenses and what have you, I couldn't find it right now, but I know the Ontario Court of Appeal decision made some comments that really annoyed me on that level, because it's almost as if you would actually have to be putting forward what the basis of your defense is before any case has been made against you, and that just is simply unacceptable. But you'll see some interesting comments in the Ontario Court of Appeal decision in this matter on that issue.
Right, we have a question back there.
Thank you. rationnel entre la pratique personnelle et le nôtre. Probablement, je ne sais pas jusqu'à quel point on est exigeant à certaines fois, est-ce qu'on demande des expertises, est-ce qu'on demande. Bon. Mais, et je reviens sur l'affaire des deux rabbins, les deux secrétaires de rabbins qui étaient contradictoires. Il était facile à la cour de dire on n'entre pas dans ce débat-là, c'est pas nous qui allons déterminer le contenu des religions. Fort bien, mais au moins dans ce cas-là, c'est possible de dire parce qu'il y avait une preuve. Voyez-vous. La contradictoire mérite là. Il y avait au moins une preuve d'expert qui disait le livre, c'est lui. Tandis que dans l'affaire du Mikal, à ma connaissance, il y a plein de jours des justices canadiennes, de quelque chose que ce soit, qui a entendu une preuve. Au-delà de l'affirmation de la personne, ma croyance dans le monde du cas est liée à la croyance. Et ça, pour moi, c'est très important.
Alors, est-ce que votre question est que la Cour suprême du Canada doit exiger un test un peu plus avec la preuve? OK. Alors, on demande à nos conférenciers de répondre à la question, tenant compte du fait que la Cour européenne de justice, dans une affaire analogue, a un test plus exigeant, plus qu'une croyance sincère qui implique la preuve, une preuve. Est-ce que vous pensez que c'est une solution pour le Canada ou est-ce que vous pensez que c'est une meilleure solution? Ça sera la dernière question. Qui veut répondre? Who would like to respond?
I'll try and attempt to respond to that question. I think that the reason why we have the Amsalem decision is because the court is really reluctant to get into the business of theological opinions, because for every opinion there's a counter opinion. So I think that the way in which religious freedom jurisprudence has been crafted in Canada is just precisely to avoid getting courts entangled in that religious domain, and because also the secular and religious premises are almost incommensurable. So I think that this is probably a wise way. And it's not as if sincerity of belief is just something you have to assert and that's the end of the story. No, it has to have a nexus with religion, and there are further conditions in the Amsalem case. So it's beyond just a bald assertion that, yes, it's my belief that I need to wear the Quran. So I think it's a wise way of going about it, personally.
Okay. Well, with that, I would like on your behalf to thank all our panelists and our president d'honneur for a wonderful evening. Thank you all for being a wonderful audience, and don't forget that pledge form. See you next year.